But over the course of 11 years, I sort of found the values through the teammates that I work with that I now, if you cut me in half, are like letters in a stick of rock. And the reason that kick not going over didn't matter is, what do I actually remember about being part of that team? It's not a million people on the streets. Whether that kick goes over or not actually doesn't define me in a way. What I still believe is the more important story in life is...
I want to ask you guys a question. Have you had a good 2 days? Yeah. Awesome. So here's what I'd like to do is we have a special guest that we're going to get up here in a moment, and I don't know if he knows even the story how he ended up actually coming through and being here today. So I'm a huge rugby, you guys know I'm a huge rugby fan, yes? So first of all, he broke my heart many times. One particular charge down against South Africa, I think we got our biggest hiding from England. He had an integral part to play in that. So started as potentially not a fan, but in admiration of who he was as a rugby player. And then as luck would go on, I found out, so I saw him on TV, etc. And I always thought to myself, he's got like a bit of a gift of the gab, and his energy was great. And my brother and I always used to talk about him. He was always a pundit on TV, and one of the things he did was he used to commentate from the side of the field for one of the rugby teams, and he just looked so passionate about what he did. And whenever you see someone passionate about what they do, how many of you guys agree, it's infectious, yes? It's infectious, you know? Just a real team man I remember my brother saying to me, like, he looks like, I would love Will to be my coach, whatever it is. Like, in whatever it is, because he's just so passionate about it, and he just wants the best for the team, etc. Just a real team man. I think he's the kind of guy that is basically like two or three team members in a team, just because it's him, the physical him, and then there's this energy that he brings. And we always saw that with how passionate he was. And then one day, believe it or not, I was having a haircut. Shut up. I was having my head shaved, okay? There's this barber in Maidenhead, and I'm sitting there and having my head shaved, right? And then I look to the side, and who's sitting next to me? The amazing rugby player I was talking about, now Mr. Will Greenwood. And you know that little voice in your head, you go, oh, come on, introduce yourself. Because I always wanted Will to come speak at one of my events. Introduce yourself. And you know, that little voice in your head went, come on, Ryan, are you a man or are you a... And my little voice went, squeak. and I was like, oh, the guy's having a haircut, I'm not going to bother him now. It's like, this is lame, you know. So anyway, he went away, and I really beat myself up for ages. I'm like, shut up, you've wanted Will Greenwood to come speak at your event for so long. He was sitting next to you at a fucking hairdresser. I know that's even hard to believe looking at me. And you didn't go say something. You're an idiot, right? And then fast forward probably like anywhere from 6 to 12 months, I don't quite know how long, my wife and I are sitting at a coffee shop in Maidenhead having coffee, and which is three doors down from the barber where I messed it up with Will, right? And I'm sitting having coffee with my wife, and you will not believe it, but some guy literally walks up to me and taps me on the shoulder and goes, hey mate, do you mind looking after my bike while I get some coffee? And who is it? It's Will Greenwood, right? And at that moment, I was like, wow, the universe is trying to tell me something here. Literally taps me on the shoulder and goes, thing. And I just thought I would say, hey, well, lovely to meet you. I've been trying to get hold of you for a while. And he was amazing from there. He's now under chiropractic care. And we look after some of his rugby guys through that. And he's like, just everything was like, whenever I could be there, whenever I can serve you, however I can help you, I'd love to be there. I had one lunch with him. And it's amazing when you hang around these people. One of my points of failure was, it just doesn't make any sense to me why you guys aren't observing more, spending time with these people. And I had one lunch with Will, and he said one sentence that I was like, wow, we're going to have a great session. And I said to him, you're going to enjoy the day. It's good energy and great people in the room. And he said, oh, man, that's good to hear. Because energy He wrote this down. I'll write this down. Write this down moment. He said, it's the only non-negotiable. He said, it's a non-negotiable. And I was like, fuck. You know, we always say, one of the things is play at 100%. It's a non-negotiable for success. The person with the highest energy always
wins.
It's a non-negotiable. And like that one, just the way he put it, it's like, it's a non-negotiable. Energy is a non-negotiable. You want to be, lack of energy pays very poorly. So let me tell you about Will a little bit. I don't know if you guys know this about Will. How many of you have ever watched Will play rugby on TV before? Awesome. How many of you ever seen him be a pundit on TV before? Yeah, I've watched many times, right? Will Greenwood is one of England's greatest ever rugby players. In a professional career, he spanned over 11 years, 55 international caps. He established himself as an incredible midfielder and, as I say, broke my heart many times. He's the second highest international try-scoring centre of all time. So we have some the Irish and the Welsh rugby players in the room. Pipe down, yeah. He's won the World Cup with England. He's gone on to achieve many things in business. How many of you have his new leadership book? Awesome, awesome, amazing. Yes, it's amazing what I'm really learning from it, etc. So, without further ado, please do me the massive favor, join me on your feet, and welcome to the stage the incredible Mr. Will Greenwood.
Thank you. Check in and check out, and sometimes you're having an average day and you're fighting loads of fires and you're not sure where to go, your head's everywhere. I'm thinking, what do I do? I've got to be there, blah, blah. Head's going crazy. I sit at the room, I went, oh, breathe. The energy in here is just ridiculous. Can I make one suggestion? I know, I'm very, very careful in and around it. No. I love rounds of applause, right? Mm. And they're good. Can I give you two options? And then you can choose which ones you use. So Martin Johnson, my great captain, he was never sure about rounds of applause because he wasn't sure how enthusiastic to be, when to start, how long to keep going for, and how much energy to throw into it. So he introduced, so I'm going to offer you two alternatives that you might want to trial every now and again. He offered us what we'd finish every training session, we'd start every session, we'd propose someone who trained well, we'd propose a cause, we'd propose a team, and we'd do the one clap. And I would count that, John would go, guys, on three, I'd like you to give a massive one clap for Ryan, and he'd go, three, two, one, bang, and we'd all do one clap. So I want you to put all your phones down, when you get both your hands ready, I'm going to see the power of unity, this power of teamwork. And the good thing about this is you don't need to be tepid with the one clap. You don't, you know, this isn't going to last 35 seconds. It's one total effort. So on three, a one clap for the legend that is Ryan. Three, two, one. So that's almost in sync. Almost in sync. But that's one way we used to do it. The other one I came across recently is for inclusivity for those who have a hearing impairment or occasionally might actually find lots of loud noise anxiety creating. So I came across it, and the University of Manchester first introduced it. I mean, it's been going on for 100 years, but they brought it back in. Originally, everyone thought, well, I'm not sure that's me, but until you try something, you never know. I defy you to be miserable on this next bit. So what I want to do is I want you to do jazz hands, okay? So we're going to do massive jazz hands for Ryan. Are you ready? Three, two, one, go. Right? You can't be miserable doing jazz hands. So, you're always looking for different things to try. I didn't know where we were going to start
Cup,
today.
World Cup winning centre, hard man, introduces audience to jazz hands.
So look, I have interest. Okay, so let's have a little vote. So you've got the normal round of applause, you've got the one clap, and you've got jazz hands. If you had to choose now to only ever use one style for the rest of your life, I want hands in the air for a neurotypical round of applause. Wow. Well, good. It's good to be different. When others are zigging, you zag. You do that. I want all the hands in the air who would like to use a one clap. Strong, strong. And who loves and would like, if they only had one option for the rest of their life, jazz hands. I mean, there you go. You get unless and one of the things we'll talk about today is I have the most amazing lady, a South African, to thank for us winning a World Cup. Mm-hmm. You're like, whoa, what's the heck's going on there? Yeah. Is she a traitor? She actually returned back to South Africa before New Zealand won back-to-back World Cup winners medals in 2011 and 2015. The only person in men's rugby who'd won consecutive medals was a lady called Cheryl. And she came to present. She watched us train up on the hill at Penny Hill Park. Clive would bring all sorts of business leaders in, private equity, different vision, different lenses on the same problem. Are you surrounding yourself with enough diversity of opinion? Are you surrounding yourself with enough people who are having a different view of the same mountain to make sure you're not getting stuck in a rut or leading your team off a cliff by missing something that's really obvious to someone on the outside, but you can't see the wood for your trees? And Cheryl, after 2 weeks of watching us, came down and presented and went, wow, there's some serious muscle power in here. You guys, you've got the lung capacity of an Ethiopian middle distance runner. Some of you guys have got fast twitch buttocks like a Jamaican sprinter. But you're ignoring the most important muscle in your body. And we're like, wow, biceps, triceps, traps, what is it? She goes, the eye. The eye is a muscle. My name is Dr. Cheryl Calder, and I'm a vision coach. And over the course of the next 3 years, with eye patches, with computer games, with lights in dark rooms, with rugby balls, with bells on, with completely blindfolded, we began to train the eye to increase its capacity for peripheral vision. And then on the back of that, by lifting up that stone, we found actually what we were doing is focusing on the ball the whole time, not looking for space. I love maths. A rugby field is 100 metres long, 70 metres wide. That's 7,000 square metres. Couldn't work out as English people who wanted to be on cameras. Their mums see them at home. We would spread out in a bunch. Absolutely all. You could throw a blanket over us at time, missing opportunities against the best teams in the world, like South Africa. So she gave us an acronym. And if you played against us for 3 years, it wasn't a particularly complicated code, but you would have heard us, the first two or three people, looking after their particular aspect, looking after the ball, staying in their swim lane, got that done. The rest of us, there's nothing you can do there. Let them get on with that job. The ball is being looked after. Everyone else, look for space, look for opportunity. CTC, look up at the crossbar in front of you. Scan the touch lines, communicate the space. CTC, Cheryl was amazing, and that allowed us to go 16 times unbeaten against Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, the best teams in the world. And then for some reason in 2005, to finish the story, when Clive Woodward left, often what happens with a management clear out, the whole coaching organisation go, she was told her services were not required. Jake White, the South African coach, picked up the phone. Cheryl, would you like to come home? Guess who won the World Cup in 2007? South Africa. Guess who never gets mentioned? Cheryl Calder. Mm. Ask us about her. She's the most amazing woman and absolutely an integral part. So it was sort of starting with this, which is one of my soapbox discussions, is don't be a know-it-all, be a learn-it-all. Go find people, go discover people, go look, explore different businesses, go find fascinating people who you admire, tap into them, harvest the collective wisdom. And that amazing effect of thinking that will take you down one route will take you down so many more different routes. And it was a mindset that I don't think I grew up with. Mindset I grew up with in the north of England with grandparents who said you must be seen but not heard. Don't speak to elders. Just say, listen, this is how we do it up north. This is how it's always been done. Whereas Clive was someone who said, you know what, we're gonna try things. And if it doesn't work, we'll cut the rope on it and we'll shift on. We'll mitigate the cost of failure. We'll understand by trying things, what are we putting at risk? Is that element of risk worth it? Bang, we go for it. If we don't like it, cut it. If we love it, we double down on things that can offer us those opportunities. So I know that was, I don't think you've even asked me a question yet. But,
it's all good. It gives many questions because we've only just started here. And how many of you can tell straight from the word go that Will is a leader? Yes. Okay, cool. That's evident. Evident.
Can I just say one thing?
No.
But I've never seen myself as a leader. And I think one of the things that I find fascinating, if you ask me about my team, I'll tell you Martin Johnson.
My point is exactly that. Will's been speaking for a few minutes now. You have mentioned Martin Johnson's name and your captain multiple times. Yep. You've mentioned Clive Woodward's name multiple times. So my question is this. coach/leader. How important is it to have a coach/leader/mentor in your life, team, etc.?
Yeah, so they were unbelievable human beings. Real strategists. I mean, I know Martin Johnson, he doesn't understand the meaning of the word fear. There's 26,000 other words he doesn't understand, but fear is right at the top. Don't tell him I said stuff like that. We called him the Ferengi, the ribbed, four-headed monobrad character from Star Trek. But I suggest you only call him that if you know him personally. We always had a line about him. If you go after Martin Johnson, dig two graves. Because he, if you get him, he will take you with him. Anyway, sorry, another story. These great, great people who, if things were going well, it was all about the team. If things were going badly, they took the responsibility on themselves.
Yeah.
They were hugely empowering. They understood that, Martin used to call himself a humble coin tosser. He said, all I do really is call heads or tails. And he'd say, the reality, I said, what are you talking about? He said, the reality is I hopefully created a platform whereby my players feel the authority in their own particular aspect to take control of situations, to cut the umbilical cord, to not wait, to not look to the sidelines, to feel the temperature, to feel the barometer. We will look into those decisions, we will explore them. If they're good ones, we'll work out why they were good ones. And again, we'll make sure we put those in place. If they were, at the time, poor decisions, we'll work out why did we make those decisions. So huge amount of learning and retrospective looking. In advance of that, someone like Clive put us all, over a course of 2 or 3 years, put us all in charge of particular sections. Scrum, attack, line out, defense, mindset game. There was sort of, we broke the game down into 7 areas, world-class behaviors. And all of us were trialed to lead particular aspect, and some rose and enjoyed that responsibility. Others actually went, I'd prefer to be a follower. So the point being, I've always actually genuinely just seen I love telling these stories and these anecdotes from my great team, and it sounds like I was a leader. I really enjoyed my role as a follower, as a teammate. Mm. I think I'm just a really, say, what's my superset? I'm a good teammate, very loyal. I'm very good in the tactics. I'm very good in the weeds. I understand. I work from Saturday to Saturday to how to win this Saturday. I wouldn't necessarily, I'm a major strategist. So I think in all organizations, have you got the people who can hit the short-term goals, hit the short-term targets, but have you got the diversity of opinion that is actually looking and saying, let's not let the urgent get in the way of the important. Don't worry about the scoreboard. Let the performance look after itself, which I think you were talking about the operational expenditure earlier with the £25,000 investment. That doesn't make it a bad year. Actually, your performance is super, super strong.
Yes.
It's an extra byproduct cost that you've built into it, which will have a payback value of 3 or 4 years.
Yes.
But your performances, your underlying performance is key. We knew we would lose games. We didn't like losing games, but we knew on any given day in a feral sport that is rugby, someone might find a way if the weather went against us, referee went against us, injuries went against us. If a couple of variables just changed and we weren't quite on it, at the highest level of international sport, you will lose games. But what we tried to do was to make sure that if we got beat by a bloody good team. That if we got beat, they deserved to win. And that was where a situation where it wasn't always the case. But from about 2000, we went 4 years. We lost 4 games out of 50. And I genuinely look back at those games. And with real honesty and transparency, I go, we didn't deserve to win those 4 games. There were no excuses on those days. We were outplayed by a better team and we got things wrong. But I'll take those numbers. I'll take those numbers. And those numbers didn't come from thinking, shit, I've got to win, shit, I've got to win, shit, I've got to win. Those numbers came from having a relentless consistency about our basics, total control, and once you all have your own capabilities within your units, within your organization, when things don't go according to plan, you have the flexibility to change. The Marines taught us this wonderful two-word, if you can have a two-word phrase, it's 2 words, called dislocated expectations. Which is the only thing in a battle situation you can count on is things will not go according to plan. Mike Tyson had a much better way of putting it.
Yeah.
He said, everyone stepped in the ring with a plan to beat me until I punched them in the face.
Yeah.
Right? And then you just start flailing and it's like 4 weddings and a funeral and it's Colin Firth versus Hugh Grant. And you're just flailing wildly and it becomes, and that's what you must try to avoid in any organization, in any sports match, in any business, that flailing. And that the way you avoid that is like you said, it's that energy, it's that hard work, it's that graft. And then on top of that, you put the little cherries on the cake with the marginal gains, the one percenters that you go looking for with people like Cheryl.
Awesome. You guys learning something?
Yes.
Dislocated expectation. Anything you do know in business, are you going to have some tough times?
Yeah.
It's going to happen. It's impossible for it not to happen. I've read John Smith's autobiography, and he was our guest speaker at our last event, and he often talks about Nick Mallett, potentially how he spoke about Martin Johnson. I've heard Martin Johnson be described as ferociously to the nth degree competitive. And in John Smith's book, he spoke about how you could play if you played a social game of tennis with Nick Mallett, who's ex-Springer rugby coach, and then John would go play a social game of tennis with him, and he said it felt like a Wimbledon final. If you missed the point, Nick Mallett was all over you. So I wanted to like segue some of the greatest teams and leaders you've been around or coaches you've been around, this expectation of like higher performance. And how many of you watched Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary? Ferocious expectations of his team at practices. So if you could segue that a little bit, tell us about it. Because I'll say this. Sorry. This is the best leadership book I've ever read. It's called Multipliers, besides Will's. So is and one of the things in Multipliers is said great leaders are described as exhilarating yet exhausting, being around a great leader. Exhilarating yet exhausting, because they expect so much of you. So you can tell us a little about that.
Yeah, look, I just think with Martin, I think it's a slight nuance in vocabulary, and you'd be right to go. People would say, oh my God, I don't want to play five-a-side football with him because he just wants to win the whole time. And I think actually that phrase is slightly wrong.
Yeah.
I think the danger of wanting to play with Martin Johnson is he will expect you to be the best version of yourself at all time.
Yeah.
Believe me, he didn't like losing.
Yes.
But he didn't mind losing if everyone committed.
Yes.
He didn't want necessarily to have to feel the enjoyment of being in front of 80,000 people in a World Cup final. You could put him in a pub team on a Saturday afternoon in Mousley, which is where he's from, which is just outside Market Harbour, and he would be the same person as he would be in a World Cup final. And yes, you're right, that can be draining, but actually it's hugely infectious.
Yes.
Because we all want to cut corners. When we're younger, when we get older sometimes, you just think we'll just side along it. And his self-policing of his team meant that if you wanted to play in his team, you had to give everything. You absolutely said energy is a non-negotiable. I think one of the great phrases that I almost sort of have tweaked and changed it from a guy from Paul O'Connell, be the best at things that require no talent.
Mm.
And that, for me, when I'm coaching kids or down at Maidenhead or in a classroom or in some of the businesses I operate in, is total commitment, total energy, total focus on what you can do to the team, to enhance the team. And I say this with total vulnerability, that was not me as a youngster.
Yeah.
This is why I speak so highly of these people.
Yeah.
Because unless you have these role models, unless you have these mentors, unless you have these coaches, then we're all trying to reinvent the wheel ourselves. So it sort of segues into the fact, don't be afraid to ask for support. Don't be afraid to ask for help. We don't all have to be superhuman the whole time. I think that myth has been busted.
Yeah.
That vulnerability, that contextualization. I go back to one of the tools I use when I'm coaching, and they're grown men that I coach. I don't press this button very often, but I talk about investments and withdrawals. A lot of the time as a coach, I know they're going to lean on me. And they're going to need me to talk to them about the technological aspects, the functional capacity of some of the rugby stuff we do, but also they're going to come from work because the people I work with are amateurs. They've had a long day at work. They actually just want to turn up, not be shouted at, be advised, and to get on with it. But this is a two-way street. Sometimes the leader has to go. And I mark myself out of 10 at most training sessions. 9, 9, 8, 9, 3. And I'll go, guys, I'm a 3 tonight. I've had a really shitty day at work. Family stuff's going on at home. I'm here, I'm present, I know exactly what the plan is. But you need to bring the heat. You need to bring the energy. And I think the great teams have that capacity to be able to lean on each other, support each other. But that doesn't happen unless the leader, the boss, the coach, the manager, the captain, whatever title that the leader of that particular team is at any one stage, lives it, walks it, talks it, and puts some skin in the game. I'm a huge believer in them. When that sort of relationship happens, a great New Zealand coach called Razor Robertson, he's actually at the Crusaders, won 4 Super Rugby titles on the planet. Lovely human being, great surfer. He goes, "Green, it's really simple. Get the heart, get the player." And for us in work, you know, you get the heart, you get the colleague. So are you listening? Are you understanding what's behind? Are you asking, are you okay? Fine. That's not good enough. How's your mental health today? What physical health have you done in the past 2 or 3 weeks?
What's going on?
How can
today?
We help? What can we do? Do you need some down? You know, all these things that I think are critical and have been accelerated in a way by COVID is to make sure. I'm a massive believer in all meetings. Even if it takes two minutes in meetings or at the start, are you checking in on people and are you understanding what mindset, what physical and mental mindset they're arriving in at work? Because sometimes you need to make adjustments and allowances and other times you can go, I'm going to lean on her today. She's going to bring it. And I think these sorts of things are often underestimated.
It's interesting that the audience all know about some of the challenges I'm going through this week, etc. And we started the week with my leadership team, and I just went, okay, I'm a mess. I'm all over the show. We prepped hard last week. We're on track, but you guys have got it. Have you had a good mastermind?
Yes.
I was the three.
Yeah.
I was the three.
Yeah, look, I know a little bit about what you're going through at the moment. I speak very openly. The reason I went to North Pole is for a preterm labour premature research. I raise a huge amount of money for a doctor called Mark Johnson, who set up this baby charity called Born. Our first, Caroline and my first wife, child was born on the 19th of September 2002. Freddie was born at 23 weeks. He was alive for an hour. Now, 18, 19 years later, there's more of a chance, but he may have grown up with a lot of physical and mental disabilities that he'd lived with. At the time, Freddie wasn't viable. The same thing was happening in the World Cup. 4 days before we played South Africa, I got a phone call. I was in a team room playing pool with Benny Cohen. It was a hotel room, pretty similar to this. You know, these rooms are all over the world. And we'd create is our England team room, table, tennis table, pool table, some snacks at the back, all this sort of stuff. And the phone goes, and there's certain phone numbers that you just see, that just stop you in your tracks. And when you see Mark Johnson, and you know he's the obstetrician and the gynecologist that's looking after you, you go, he knows I'm in Australia, South Africa. It speaks, I think you need to come home. I think the same thing's happening. Talk about vocabulary. I mean, they need to rename this thing. And my wife's very over it. She has an incompetent cervix. I mean, what a ridiculous thing to call it, an incompetent cervix. It's like the cervix has a choice about what it's doing, you know. So she's in hospital. They have an emergency operation. They put a cervical suture in, one stitch, saved Archie's life. I flew back, but I didn't know what to do because at the time I got this phone call. We're playing South Africa in 4 days. I'm supposed to be this superhuman England international rugby player. We're playing South Africa. This is in the old days. You didn't fly back for a birth of your child. In the old days, it's like, get on with it. I was seen as, what are you? Are you soft? It's not what happens. You've got to work. And it's like, dude, that's like black and white. It's like the 17th century. It's not like that anymore. So I turned to I went to see Clive straight away and said, look, I don't know what to do. Because it's super simple. Speak to Louise Ramsey, our team manager. She booked me on every single flight out of Perth that week. And he said, if you're not training, you don't need to say why. I know if you're not there, why you've gone. There'll always be a place for you. If you need to fly home, fly home. Any stage in this World Cup, you want to come back, there's a place for you in this team. And that reassurance that actually I could breathe, calm, make the right decision.
Be vulnerable.
Spoke to Caro in hospital, decided I would stay and play the South Africa game 4 days later, which was 7 o'clock kickoff, 9 o'clock. There was a BA flight at midnight, straight to the airport from the game. Flew home, spent a week at home. Understood that things were calmer, that there was a chance we might keep the baby. And then in a very Hollywood style, Caro at the end of the week realized I was starting to wonder what was going on in Australia. She was starting to, all the vitals were much more stable. And she made the decision for me. She said, look, dead simple here. You go back and win the World Cup, I'll keep the baby. Yeah. So jump back on a plane. I mean, it's like, but you need that sort of, need that sort of support. So from my partner at home, and from my coach and from the players I've played with, there's just total understanding of the bigger picture of what's important. And I think if you know if you're in the right team, when you ask those questions, sometimes not as severe, and you sort of know they're not listening, and they're just worried about the numbers, and they don't quite get the bigger picture, and they don't take the time to slow down in order to speed up. But when you do get those right answers, you then know forevermore you will go to war for those people, and you can achieve anything with those people. So don't underestimate that ability of showing empathy and understanding for your team, even at times of stress. Do the right thing, and we all really, in our gut, know what the right thing is.
Very good. I think.
They're clever.
So it's been so interesting for me. We've had so many guest speakers, and we've had like business people, and I often tend to really lean on sports personalities. And I think it's because, if we think about it, right, marketing is marketing is marketing. Sales is sales is sales. We know we've got to do it. Most of it is getting in this room, accountability from the room to remind us, often remind ourselves of the shit we're not doing. You guys understand, yes? Then add all that much new. You guys understand that, yes? But you understand you have to show up in the environment to remind of the stuff you're not doing. But the thing that's like the secret sauce on it is, and it'll never go away, it's leadership and management and building a team and building a culture. And that type of stuff is more, I don't want to say the word esoteric, but there is an art to it, as opposed to just, you know, do the marketing, do this campaign, etc. And I've seemed to be leaning so much on sports personalities because of the unique environment of being put in a team. And like the performance is so clear on the scoreboard. Yeah. Scoreboard is just a byproduct of the culture, etc. Because I really think you put in extreme environments to create extreme results in a relatively short space of time, most of the time. So I'm interested to find out from you, your experience from sport, how has that helped you in your commercial world now, and your training world now, and business world now? And I'll even say this, is I've even heard you speak about even engaging in mental help or psychology help, etc., and your willingness to take on a coach there, I'm guessing that came a lot from your willingness to be coached in the sporting environment. Anyway, so the question would be, how has that world helped you in your business world, and what skill sets have you taken across that, or what lessons have you taken across that to manage a team or a business or commercially?
Yeah, so the fascinating thing is, there's a photo of Johnny Wilkinson as he's about to kick the drop goal with his right foot. And his foot is about to kick the ball. Right. And you might say hindsight is a wonderful thing when you've got the medal in the sock drawer. But I do genuinely believe this. I look at that photo and I go, do you know what? It doesn't matter if that kick goes over. And people are like, what are you talking about? It doesn't matter if that kick goes over. And I'll tell you why. And I'll try and explain it. And you might still think I'm mad at the end. But what those 11 years did in England camp for me was allow me to start to create my set of values. I have a load of opinions, but I tend to dance with my opinions, and I listen to other people and they change, and I don't set them in stone. But over the course of 11 years, I sort of found the values through the teammates that I work with that I now, if you cut me in half, are like letters in a stick of rock. And the reason that kick not going over didn't matter is, what do I actually remember about being part of that team? It's actually not the wonderful booze up in Australia. I literally can't remember anything about that. It's not a million people on the streets. It's lovely to meet the Queen. It's amazing to get an MBE. You know, it's lovely to get lauded by people and introduced as that. And I probably wouldn't be invited here today.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's the
runner-up in a World Cup. But actually, whether that kick goes over or not actually doesn't define me in a way. What I still believe is the more important story in life is to create an environment, to bring together a team, to work your absolute socks off, to try and define what your marginal gains might be, to create a code of conduct so you respect each other, you acknowledge other, to acknowledge each other's differences and work-ons and find a way to support each other, to put each other in positions where they can be the best version of themselves on a test match, and then under pressure to be able to react with great synchronicity as one, even though you're 15 very different shaped people with 15 very different mindsets because of all the training you've done. And if you do all that, you put yourself in a chance that whoever might be the tip of the spear gets to take the shot for you to win. So it's all about actually what we did to get to that moment. And we can talk about 5-6 year story, but it basically boils down to we did all our training to get Johnny into that position, and he's obviously rightly acknowledged as the poster boy, the very handsome devil who delivered that glory. But I see that foot and that moment representative of everything we've done. Now, again, you might go, blah, horse manure. If you'd lost it, you wouldn't say that. It would be very different. But that's how I remember it. That's how I remember that team. I don't want to go back and play any of those games. I'd love occasionally to find myself in that change room with that team 2 minutes before kickoff and just be able to look around and go, wow, look at the people. And I think we don't do this often enough, that in times of stress, in times of crisis, when you're worried about what's going to happen next and you begin to make things up and you're crossing bridges in your mind before you've even got there, just getting the team together, sitting down, looking each other square in the eye and realising the talent and the difference you've got within your team that will allow you to give yourself the best chance of success. And you know what? If it doesn't work out, failure is very rarely fatal. Mm-hmm. And that ability and having that ability to create that team environment, if you're a numbers man, which I am, the more you do that, the more likely you are to succeed.
I'm interested to hear you say twice now, actually, that you're a numbers man and a math man. How's that? What do you mean by that?
Well, I did economics and maths at Durham. I was a foreign exchange trader for HSBC for 3 years before rugby turned professional. And I am someone, there's the whole view on of 10,000 hours, which is you practice your basics and anyone can be a world champion. Actually, I think there's a build on that. There's much more nuance to that. It is a combination of both genetics and also work rate and capacity. The way I played would be put me in a team with people who absolutely are rock solid in their skill sets. The way I played is I viewed my game, my sport, as actually a game of chess, played by rather large moving parts, who, if they were South African, tried to remove your head at the first available opportunity. But it was still, Andre Venter would be a castle, and you know, you could go through your team and you could have different skill sets associated with different chess pieces. And it's about maneuvering the team around, understanding the risk reward of how to give yourself the best chance to take the shot when it came. So I am a... In terms of a rugby sense of the world, I've always believed that the strong take from the weak, but the smart take from the strong. It's the only way that I could ever convince myself to take a field against people like Jonah Loma. I mean, I look like Montgomery Burns. I'm a complete stick man. My nickname was Shaggy, the cartoon character. I grew up on pot noodles. I never lifted a weight until I was 27 years old. And I was surrounded by these behemoths who were 125 kilos, 6'5", and ran the 100 in about 10.7 seconds. I had imposter syndrome cursing through my veins. And yet, how did I find the way to do that? Is to understand, okay, yeah, but these are the pieces. And right, they might have those strengths, but let's move it around. And I think it all comes back to maths, odds, probability. I love the Queen's Gambit. These sorts of shows that you watch and you begin to understand, if you keep practicing and keep putting yourself in different scenarios, you continue to stress test yourself, continue to come to days like these to pick up a little nugget from absolutely everyone, you're slowly equipping yourself with more pieces of the jigsaw. Unless you're doing things like that, you're trying to do a 1,000-piece jigsaw with 27 pieces. It's never going to snap into focus. And that's my particular mindset about my sport, and having a mother who was a math teacher for 35 years. I think there's beauty in maths and problem solving. So if you were to say, what is my super strength? I'm a good problem solver. I don't know what today's problem is. I don't know what tomorrow's problem will be. But I know if I apply logic and math to it, and I have other people who have a slightly more left side of the brain and say, you're looking at it wrong, you need to tweak it a little bit and throw a couple more variables in, then slowly but surely, with the variety of different perspectives I can surround myself, as I said, the picture often, more often than not, doesn't always, but tends to snap into focus.
So interesting, because you know, one of our points we spoke about just before we walked in was, I sometimes think the phrase keep it simple can be oversimplified in such a said by people that often justify the position that they're in by keep it simple. And we're talking about sometimes you've got to go deep knowledge and you've got to go deeper level of knowing your statistics. And I mean, there's nothing today's rugby games. I mean, with the quadrants and the way they analyze the game, it's so deep. And it's so interesting because we were just speaking about that today, weren't we, guys? Yeah, so to hear you say that from a sporting background is just fascinating, you know, and that's how we can take it into business. Everyone say...
As we went into extra time, Martin Johnson, I talk about him again here, he looked at us, and there's times, you're right, there's times when you need to knuckle down and you need to come up with a five-year business plan, and you need to really work it out, what's our opportunity, what's our USP? If we didn't exist... What is it that the world will be missing on? Okay, right, let's double down on that. Let's make sure we're absolutely the best on that. And how do we create an environment for that to happen? Then there are other times, and it might be a tenuous segue, but to talk about keeping it simple. Martin looked at us and went, like, it's super simple, lads. In the next 20 minutes, which is extra time. If you see a bloke in yellow with the ball, smack him. Right? And if you've got the ball, run that way. Right, and you're thinking, wow. And he turned to set off. He turned to set off, and he just turned and said one more thing. He says, but don't leave this field a beaten man. And then he set off with his giant number four, and he just thought, shit, I'm following this bloke anyway. Yeah. So that whole point of simplicity, there are times to over-peel the onion. Mm. There are strategy and away days when you get into levels of detail that you think, wow, are we going this deep? And then there's other times when you just got to knuckle down, roll the sleeves up and crack on, get on, shut up and move on, sumo. And there's times for that, and there's times actually, no, this isn't a sumo moment. Yeah. This is a more of an existential crisis to our very organization and our team. We need to find we need to go more into the detail. We need to get extra help from outside. And the great teams understand which quadrant these big decisions come in. But then commit, and one of my great phrases that the kids love is the road of life is paved with flat squirrels that couldn't make a decision. Right? Right? It is. So don't be, and it's dead simple, at my team at work, it's like, don't be a flat squirrel. We agree, disagree, we commit, we go for it, we fail, we go again, but we don't get stuck in the middle of the road going, what do we do now?
Awesome. You guys learning something? Yeah. Awesome, awesome. So here's the thing. We want to slowly start wrapping up, but I would love to take some questions from the audience. So is there anyone that would like to ask Will a question? Go for it. Andy? So I'll grab. Can we have Andy a microphone there? Give Andy a round of applause.
Hello. I'm kind of fanboying a little bit, because I'm not going to lie, you and the whole team are still pride of place in my house. I've got a big picture of you from 2003, so it's amazing to meet, to kind of see you, so thank you. One of the things I've always known about, like, Sir Clive when he came into the England team was, and I'm hoping this is true and you're not going to tell me otherwise, but one of the big things he did was he brought in, and you mentioned the code of conduct, where he actually got the team to develop the code of conduct themselves, so they had ownership of it. Yeah. And I believe when he joined the 2012 campaign for the Olympics, he did the same with them. What difference did that actually make? Because obviously you kind of played before him when he came in. What difference did that actually make to the team, the bonding and the ownership of it?
There's a fascinating story as to how that started. We started to get better as a team, but still lose the occasional game. So he said, let's go train with the Royal Marines. And we basically did two summers of SAS Who Dares Wins. All the stuff they do, helicopter simulator crashes, leaps of faith, all that stuff, all that cold water stuff, we did for two summers. I look back on it 30 years later and go, that was great fun. my God, that was proper. Look, I would not have been a good Royal Marine. But at the end of the first campaign down there at Limpston with the guys, the commandant of the Marines, a guy called Adam Malilieu, came over to Clive with a piece of paper. We're all setting off. We're all feeling good about ourselves. Yeah, we've come through this. We're, you know, SCS, who does wins, it wasn't existed, but if it existed, we all passed with flying colours. We're all getting our green beret. Here we go. Yeah, let's rock. And a piece of paper, he said, I'm going to... And on that piece of paper were six names. And he said, I wouldn't go to war with those six people.
Wow.
And it's like, oh, okay. And then, look, Clive's never revealed the names, but he's always had a quiet joke with me about it. He goes, shit, they are my best players. So now what do you do? Because you're looking at your best players, but the Marines guy's saying that there's no collective, there's no teamship, they're playing for the wrong reasons. And where Clive was really clever is he took his time and thought about it. He realized actually it's because they're judging us on their parameters, which are very clear, their code of conduct, the way they would treat each other and want to be treated. Don't treat people as you would love it to be treated. Treat people as they would like to be treated. And so rather than boot those six people out, he went, I've got to give them the chance. So the next time we met, we spent 2 days away in a hotel similar to this, and we wrote our own code of conduct. The medical team went away, the coaching team away, the nutrition team went away, and wrote their own little subsections, and then the collective we came back together. So each particular group would have their own particular, that they would benefit from the global, but be very focused on the local, and then there would be the global, then we're all together, this is how we are. And then the first thing you got given when you arrived in a camp for England, from then on, would be your code of conduct. And you were told, because just because it's old doesn't mean it's good. But conversely, just because it's new doesn't mean it's better. But the new kids into the team would look at it, go, yeah, okay. And we'd sign it off, new squad, new campaign, Six Nations, World Cup, Lions, whatever it might be. Sign it, bang, and you're in, and you commit. And then once you've written that down, you see, it's much easier to self-please. Otherwise, you're all still naughty school kids trying to break the rules. Mm. Whereas if they're your own rules, It's very, very different indeed. So, you know, examples of no dirty kit in public, always stop and sign autographs for kids. My favourite one was Lombardi time. You know, Vince Lombardi, the greatest American football coach until the guy with Tom Brady and New England Patriots has probably gone past him. But Lombardi time meant if a team meeting started at 10, all 30 players were strapped up, ready to go at 9:45. Now, previously to that, a 10 o'clock meeting meant people drifting in at 10:05 because we weren't aware of the consequences, the importance of time. Once we introduced that and understood that time is our most precious commodity because it is finite, from there, not one person was late in 5 years because we'd created a buddy system. And if you looked around the room and if your buddy wasn't in the room, you legged it and you got him and you legged it and found out, dragged him out of bed, made sure he was in the right kit, and you began to look after each other's back. And so with that sort of policy, there's this amazing thing where, and the best way to describe it is in 1999, before we'd been to the Marines, when Clive announced the team, when we got battered by South Africa in the quarterfinal, the team was announced, 30 people in the room, 15 people in the team sheet, 15 not. The 15 not just went, sod this, not about me, on the piss. Went into Paris, got absolutely clattered. No support, just realizing it's not their scrap. 2003, same thing, 15 names on the team sheet, flip chart goes back, proper flip chart like the old days. 15 in the room going, I'm in, do I jump up and down? It's slightly awkward, there are 15 who aren't in. The first 15 people on their feet were those not in the team. Mike Catt was the first person to shake my hand. As I said, my nickname was Shaggy from the cartoon character. He'd go, Shaggy, you know my room number, you know my mobile number, anything you need to do or anything you need from me in the next 72 hours to win this for us, he would then come on with 20 minutes to go and contribute himself. But a totally different mindset, which had completely come about by creating that code of conduct. I'm hugely passionate about taking the time to write down and really articulate what you stand for collectively, how you would like to treat each other. And then from there, you can, and by signing it, you are okay to hold people to account. Otherwise, if that's not written down, it's just smoky corners, it's just cliques, it's just people breaking off in silos and sideshows, and eventually the team breaks down.
Good. Great. Yeah, good. Let's take another question. Interesting, I don't know if you noticed that Mike Catt and Sia Khaleesi both went to the school I came from.
Port Elizabeth?
Yeah.
So they both went down to Herber country.
That's right, that area. So both went to that school. Another question. Do you want to go for it?
Excuse me. I can hear you. Go and shout.
Go.
Sorry.
So kind of the question I wanted to ask was, I mean, I think we can also tell by how you speak, you're always committed, you're always passionate. When you went back to Harlequins and they got relegated, at that time you could have gone to any other team and carried on, you stuck with them. What was the thinking behind that and why?
Because I was part of the problem, I think. My dad wrote me a letter actually the year after we'd won the World Cup with some stats, and he goes, two carries, two offloads, two tackles from one particular game. He says, does this signify a lack of opportunity, or does this signify a lack of mindset? And I was like, wow, that is punchy. And sometimes you need, he's my biggest fan, and I was like, I need to reset because I am getting things wrong. I'm living off the hype. And part of that, then, if you're only doing that for your country, can you imagine how shit my stats were for my club? You know, and there was that real understanding. You looked at it and we found ourselves down the bottom, and it came down to the last game, and the wonder try was scored by Sale Sharks and Jason Robinson, and we're like, I'm walking off the field going, oh my God.
Relegated.
We've been relegated, you know, and they said, this is not a good thing. This is Harlequins. We're not too big to go down because we've just gone down. And the amazing South African owners, Charles Gillings and Duncan Saville, wonderful human beings, addressed us and gave us the opportunity and said, look, you can either be part of the cure, part of the solution, or we totally understand some of you superstars will walk, but we need you completely committed. And my view was, if I'd gone then, I don't think I could look myself in the eye. I'd have gone because I'd have been going for some bucks somewhere else. And actually, the reason we were going down was probably three or four of the senior players not pulling their weight. It was a heck of a lesson to learn. And I then had the most enjoyable year, one of the most enjoyable years, down below, bringing players through like Mike Brown and Chris Robshaw and Hugo Monya, Danny Kerr, people who would go on to do great things, playing alongside these young kids and showing that you've got to take responsibility for your actions. So, that's why I look back on it. It's not a particularly proud moment in my career. I realised there was a time where there's a great lady who said, you know, why, when we won the World Cup, why bother running for the bus when you've already caught it? And in my own mind, I think it's very easy to look and tell people what to do and not actually follow through on those actions. So I hope that answers the question. But the reality was, I felt as though I was a good chunk of the reason we did go down, and it would have been, cowardly is too strong a word, but it would have been, it wouldn't have had integrity to walk away. And I think a lot of us, for me, my reputation is a lot of what I trade on, and it only takes one or two bad incidents, and they tend to be the ones people remember.
Thank you. Good job. Good job. Okay. We'll take one more question at the back, Gareth, and then we'll slowly start.
There must be a lady who wants to ask a question.
Let's take Mary first. Let's take Mary first, and then the big Welsh rugby player can wait.
It's great to see Wales on the crest of another slump. I can't hear you. You haven't got a microphone. Blah, 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 Wales. Blah, 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 Wales.
Go for a question.
Firstly, thank you so much for your time today. I think we've all learned so much from this. And I'm looking forward to going home and talking to my daughter about your qualities to help her improve with her sporting life. And I know there's going to be one question that she's going to ask me when I get back, so I'd like to ask you that, if that's okay. Which pot noodle should she be eating?
Chicken and mushroom. Neither. They're awful. There's more nutritional value in a cardboard box. I mean, really. But if you are asking, chicken and mushroom.
Thank you. I'll forgive you for the World Cup in 2003. Well, that's fine. what I wanted to ask about is that really, obviously, you're a very busy man with your hand in multiple pies, but I have three young boys myself, and just the mindset side of being able to go from sort of working environment, etc., to then being more present at home and being able to do that is something I've being totally vulnerable, sometimes struggle with, like in terms of there's no choice to be present at work if you want to perform properly. But what sort of tips and things would you give about being able to be the most present, like father and husband and stuff at home, I think?
Yeah, so firstly, I want people to be kind to themselves and understand it's tough. You got to graft. There are sacrifices to make. So first of all, don't beat yourself up. I'm sure you're doing an amazing job. But we all want to be better. We all want to be the perfect mum, the perfect dad. So my view on this would be to map out the perfect dad you want to be, and then don't try and make all those 10 changes in one go. Yeah. I'm a big believer in picking one or two things, trialing it. It might be that you try to finish work at 5 o'clock every day, you drive home and you do half an hour in the car on your phone where you, like for any calls that have come back in, you finish it and then you bang, put it away. It might be that the phone goes in a drawer when you get out. Look, yeah. All these are totally negotiable and you will find them. And some won't work, and yeah. Some that will work for Ryan and some that will work for me won't be appropriate for you. Yeah. But I think the reality is, as if I go back very quickly to the rugby analogy, Clive always said to us, it's not one thing 100% better. It's 100 things 1% better. Yeah. So chip away at it. Just keep in the back of your mind trying to be that best version of yourself. Yeah. But pick out two or three things and try them. They won't all work, and the ones that do work, they'll become part of you and part of the system. And actually, I hope that answers the question. I'm having exactly the same problems.
Yeah, I think it's a continual problem.
Yeah, right? And you know, Sunday's the phone now. For me, it's gone. It gets put away on a Saturday night. It gets picked back up on a Monday.
Yeah.
That's a little thing. They're coming home in the Tuesday, Thursday and rugby and Sunday and Matilda, three school runs a week, no matter what. Again,
yeah.
I'm just giving you examples of things I'm trialing, and I worked out three was too many, so I'll do two.
Yeah.
So set yourself some targets and try them out, stress test them, and don't be embarrassed to quit on them, but stick to ones that do work.
Mm. Yeah, brilliant. Thank you so much. Cheers.
Awesome. Well, first of all, did you guys have a good time with Will? So Will can actually stand up here, do my bit of a wrap up here. But first of all, I just want to say thanks so much, man. Like from the very first time I reached out to you, you were just like, I'll help you. Let's meet for lunch. You were so interested in my business, and most importantly, I think just the common goal of helping people perform better. I think that's in your DNA. I think you enjoy that. You said one of your most enjoyable years was helping mentor people through. So I think, I don't believe in, there's no coincidences. I think there's a reason I was having a haircut next to you in Maidenhead, and then you came for that cycle. I can humbly say that, you know, I can tell, you know, when a speaker has nailed it and done well. But it's safe to say, man, that we learned so much from you today. So thank you so much. Would you guys agree?
Yes. Yes. Oh. Really kind. Really kind. I know you're going to wrap up.
Yeah.
You do meet people in life. And when you meet people in life, ask that question in the hairdresser next time. But, you know, if you, my view, Dr. Pepper, what's the worst that can happen? If you're polite, you ask properly, you might get a no. But so what? What's a no? More often than not, you meet people who might be your heroes or you might be able to learn something. They're happy to help. The reason they're there is they have that drive and that energy. And I could tell straight away, without blowing sunshine at your backside, after half an hour sitting and have a coffee with you, I could come along and find a different way to run a meeting. I could find along, come away and pick up two or three different points. I found a book that I need to read. And unless you try these things out, you just don't know where they'll lead. So I'm really appreciative for your time. For the microphone, for an audience, and I think we're staying for some photos. If anyone wants a photo with Rodney Trotter, then that's great. And a coffee, and then I hope you all have a wonderful weekend, and England beat South Africa by 75 points.
Ah!